Well, it's good to see everybody out tonight. I'm glad that you're here. Tonight begins, like was mentioned already, the first night of this series of studies. And what we're going to be doing, as I mentioned this morning, is we're going to be looking through the book of Matthew. Now, Matthew's set up, I think, in an interesting way. There are five major discourses in the book of Matthew. And the first one's the one that we're going to look at tonight. It's Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. The Sermon on the Mount, but some of the others that we might mention, you could see like in Matthew chapter 13 is a series of parables. All the parables, primarily all the parables that Jesus tells in Matthew are all put together in chapter 13. And I think what happens there is that you're seeing a reaction to Jesus in these parables. Jesus explaining the reaction that people have to him with these parables. And then he springs from the reaction that people have had to him to, this is the way you're going to be treated as well. And so you need to understand that's what's going to happen. So you've got Matthew chapter 13, the discussion of these parables. And then, of course, later on in chapter 23, 24, chapter 25, you have this judgment being pronounced, as we talked about briefly this morning. So there's five major discourses in the book of Matthew, and we want to look at the first one tonight. Tonight's lesson, of course, is entitled Christianity Concentrate. I don't know if any of you ever drank frozen orange juice. I'm not a big fan of orange juice in general, but when I was a kid, sometimes we would get frozen concentrate, and that's really what it is. I mean, if you're going to have orange juice, spooning it off, so most frozen concentrate, that's the way to go. But you just add water to this, thin it out a little bit, and there you go. There's your orange juice concentrate. We want to talk about Christianity concentrate for a few moments tonight, because I think that's what we have in the Sermon on the Mount. So Matthew places this sermon in a strategic way. As I already mentioned, there are five major discourses in the book of Matthew, and he just happens to begin with the Sermon on the Mount. But why? Why does he put it here? Because there are other places where a similar sermon's found, like in Luke. In Luke chapter 6, and of course that's early again in the book of Luke, but in the timeline in Luke, the sermon that Jesus preaches is slightly later. Now, there are a lot of similarities between what we read in Luke chapter 6 and the Sermon on the Mount known in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. There are some differences, however, in the Sermon on the Mount. It's the Sermon on the Mount. In Luke, Jesus goes out on a plain, or it's the Sermon on the Plain. So the question might be, well, are these two different sermons on two different occasions? Well, that's certainly possible. It's certainly possible, but Jesus as the model preacher, there are several preachers here tonight, myself being one of them. This isn't the first time that I've gone through this sermon. So, you know, if somebody, I don't know why anybody would do this, but if somebody might hear this sermon later or see maybe some transcript of this message, or maybe just my outline, okay? Somebody just sees my outline. The kids see my outline some years later, and they see, like in the beginning slide, it had Omaha, Nebraska, and they say, well, that's the Omaha sermon. And then they happen to find another flash drive where I've got these same slides on it, but it said, you know, Robinson, Illinois. Well, that's the Illinois sermon. Well, are they different sermons? Well, no, I just happen to preach them at different places at different times. I don't think that would be unheard of for Jesus to be preaching a very similar message at different places to different people at different times, in different locations. So maybe one time it's on a mountain, one time it's on a plain. It may also be the very same occasion, because Jesus may have gone on the mountain and the people be spread about on the plain so that they could hear in this kind of natural setting. That may be what's happening here. But whatever's happening in Luke, it's taking place chronologically later, because that's what Luke is specifically trying to do. He's laying things out in a chronological way. At least that's the way I understand what Luke is doing. But Matthew is not bound by that. Matthew's not trying to lay these things out. This happened, and then secondly, this happened, and then later afterwards, this happened. Matthew has a different point in mind. Matthew's trying to do something very different with his sermon. So, as I mentioned, it may be different place. So why would Matthew place it here before any of the parables, before any of the arguments with the Pharisees, the scribes, the Sadducees? Why is it that Jesus, or Matthew rather, why is it that he places it here? Well, because it's an introduction to Christianity. If you want to know what it is to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, if you want to know what it is all about to follow the Lord, if you want to know what Christianity is at the root of it, the Sermon on the Mount is the place to look. You've heard people talk about the gospel in a nutshell, John chapter 3 and verse 16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. This is Christianity in a nutshell. This is what it is all boiled down. This is Christianity concentrate. Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. So, what is Christianity all about? Well, just a few points that I'd like to share with you up from the Sermon on the Mount. First of all, Christianity is about being blessed. A Christian is blessed. That's the way that he begins, right? The Beatitudes. Have you heard about the Beatitudes? That's the introduction to the introduction, right? If the Sermon on the Mount is the whole introduction to Christianity, the Beatitudes are the introduction to that introduction. That's what it's all about. It's about being blessed. Blessed are the, right? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed. You're blessed. Christians are blessed. That's what the Sermon on the Mount's talking about. That's what it is to be a Christian. You are blessed. The Beatitudes. What is a Beatitude? I know this is going to sound really dim. I don't believe I've ever told anyone that I was overly smart, and I don't think I've ever been able to pretend well enough to convince anybody that I was. But years ago, I thought, well, maybe they're Beatitudes because they all begin with the letter B. I don't know. They all begin with the letter B. Or maybe it's because they're attitudes that we ought to have. These are the attitudes that we ought to be. That makes sense to me. I'm not great at spelling. There may be mistakes in these slides throughout the week. Just be aware of that. It did dawn on me eventually, the attitude and beatitude, that the attitude part, they're not spelled the same. So I thought, well, maybe that's not what it is. Well, come to find out, well, no, what it is, it comes from the Latin, translation of the Bible. And it just means happy or blessed. That's all it is. Christians are blessed. That's what the Beatitudes are saying. Over and over and over, Jesus is drumming on this point. He's hammering this point home. You are blessed. If you follow me, you are a blessed person. If you're a Christian, disciple of the Lord, you are blessed. Do not be mistaken. Do not be fooled. You are blessed. And I think there are plenty of scriptures that go along with it. We could look at a place like Ephesians chapter 1. Have you studied Ephesians? Oh, I'm sure you've studied Ephesians. Ephesians is wonderful. Six chapters, nicely divides the first three chapters and the second three chapters. The first three chapters, Paul talks about all the things that God has done for us. And then the last three chapters, Paul talks about the things that we ought to do in response to that. He encourages to live in a manner that's worthy of the gospel. And I think that idea of worthy doesn't mean that you deserve it, but walk in a manner that reflects what God is and what the gospel has done for you. It's the practical part, I think, is the way it's often described. But Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 3 lays out the theme. At least that's what I think what's happening there in verse 3 is that Paul's laying out the theme of the entire book in that third verse. And what does that third verse say? Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us. We ought to praise God, bless God, live in a way that reflects God's holiness and goodness and greatness because he has blessed us. And what does Paul do the rest of chapter 1? He enumerates those blessings. Now, in chapter 2, he comes back and he summarizes all of it in the concept of being saved. By grace have you been saved. But in chapter 1, he spends a great deal of effort enumerating various blessings that are all found in Jesus Christ. Christians are blessed. That's what the Bible teaches in the Sermon on the Mount, in the book of Ephesians, wherever we may go. We could go over to the book of Revelation. In the first chapter again, in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 3, there's a blessing that's being pronounced here for those that read and those that hear the message of the book of Revelation. There's a blessing here for God's people. That's the point. Or we could go to a place like Matthew chapter 25. In Matthew chapter 25, where Jesus is picturing this great judgment scene that we talked about this morning already, where he separates the people to the right and to the left, the sheep from the goats. And then he says in verse 34, to those on his right, those that served him by serving the least of his brethren, he says, enter in, blessed. Those that are blessed. That's who he's talking about, those that are blessed. Christians are a blessed people. That's certainly what the Bible's teaching. And so you have to wonder then, if I'm miserable, why? Why does it appear that God's people, the church people, why does it appear that so many are unhappy and so many are miserable? Maybe they just not. What's that old song? Count your many blessings. Maybe they've just failed to count their blessings. Maybe they've forgotten how blessed they really are. Maybe they just don't know what they really have. You're blessed. Don't forget it. Don't let anyone steal that away from you. A Christian is blessed. Well, secondly, a Christian points people to God. Again, that's, I think, what we see in the Sermon on the Mount is that a Christian points people to God. Look with me, if you will, at Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, and right after the Beatitudes in verse 13, Jesus uses two illustrations to describe what it is to be a disciple of his, to be a Christian. What is it all about? Well, he says in verse 13, 14, 15, and 16, he says, you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all that are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Now, of course, there are two illustrations that are being used here, salt and light. And the point is that they both have influence over their surroundings, but neither are good by themselves. Can you imagine taking a spoonful of salt? And I don't know why I have this thought, but I used to get occasionally I'd get like a canker sore. And I had this thought that if medicine doesn't taste bad, then it's not working. I don't know if anybody else has ever thought that. But if medicine doesn't taste bad, then it can't work. And so if you take something that really, really is taste awful, it must be good for you. So I would put a little salt in there. Not pleasant at all. I'm not sure that it helped any, but it was not pleasant. Nobody would ever think of eating a spoonful of salt. You've probably heard the song about a spoonful of sugar, but nobody ever sang about spoonfuls of salt. Nobody would suggest that you look at a light bulb. There was an eclipse here some months ago, back this past summer. Any of you go watch that or go see that? What were you told? Don't look directly at it. Don't look directly at the sun. That's bad for you. We're thankful for the sun and all the things that it illuminates, but nobody pays attention specifically to the sun. We're thankful for the influence that salt has in the food that we eat. And when you're not allowed to have it anymore, you kind of miss it, don't you? We're thankful, but nobody's going to eat it all by itself. Christians point people to God. But if they're not pointing people to the Lord, if we're only pointing people to ourselves, what good are we? I'll tell you, we'd be about as distasteful as eating a spoonful of salt. Christians point people to God. So how do they do that? Well, of course, through preaching. That's certainly one way, but you've probably heard people say things like, I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day. That is not to suggest that simply by our actions, people will come to know the Lord. You cannot preach Jesus Christ without preaching words. The gospel is a gospel of words. There's a message here. But there have been certainly the case could be made that there are many people that have spoken through words and have ruined the message by horrible behavior. Christians point people to God. We point them together to God by our good behavior. John chapter 13 and verse 35, passage we mentioned this morning. By this, all men will know that you're my disciples if you love one another. Now, again, that does not preclude proper teaching. It doesn't preclude the message. But Jesus' emphasis here is on our actions, the way that we live, the way that we conduct ourselves. And so we have to ask ourselves, well, what do fights and divisions and fussing and squabbling, what does that convey? Several years ago, maybe you heard about this, Josh Duggar. I didn't watch the television show, but I know that it was very popular. But when it came out about his misdeeds, his personal misdeeds, his personal failings, his personal sins, what was the view of Christianity as a whole? Just using that as an illustration, what was the impact on the whole of Christianity, the whole of those that read the Bible, because of one man's influence? Maybe third, a Christian trusts God. Isn't that the message of the Sermon on the Mount? This is what it is to be a Christian. It's one to trust God. Again, read with me, if you will, from chapter 6 this time. What Jesus does, by the way, in the rest of the chapter, the rest of chapter 5, is he immediately steps aside from this and he says, do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. He explains what he's doing. But you'll notice at the very beginning of chapter 6, beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them, is the exact same concept that he had talked about in the end of verse 16 about letting your light shine before men. Practicing your righteousness before men, either to be noticed by them or to point people to God. So he's picking back up on the theme at the beginning of chapter 6. The rest of chapter 5, it's been an aside and it's an explanation of what he's doing. But here in chapter 6, go down to verse 19. He gives three examples of righteousness. He talks about giving alms. He talks about fasting. He talks about prayer here. But then he says in verse 19, he says, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasure in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. So then if your eye is clear, your whole body will be full of light. An idea of clear eyes, a single eye, focused eye. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. And then how deep is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. You'll either love the one, hate the other. And then he talks about worry there in verse 25. Don't be worried about the things that you're going to eat, about your life, about what you're going to drink, what you're going to put on. I tell you what, I worry about a lot of things. Well, let me rephrase that. I know I ought not to worry about a lot of things, but when I worry, I don't worry generally about what I'm going to eat and what I'm going to drink. Do you? I don't worry about that stuff. I don't have a really big pantry, but I know I could at least get a couple days worth out of it. I don't worry about that stuff. That seems small, doesn't it? That seems insignificant. That seems so far beyond what we in our very safe society would ever feel like we would have to worry about. Worry a little bit about the stock market dropping. And my retirement fund. I worry about those things sometimes. So I quit watching the market. I don't watch the news anymore because there's plenty of stuff on there to watch or to worry about. And, you know, food and drink and clothing, the necessities of life, they're not generally the things that we worry about because it seems so far removed from us. And yet, if God can take care of those things, certainly can take care of everything else. You have what you need. He gives some illustrations about how God takes care of the grass of the field, stuff that we don't even pay attention to that stuff. It's beyond our notice. We couldn't care less about it. The birds of the air. Last Sunday night, when going to church, there in Robinson, Illinois, we're not very far from the Wabash River that separates Indiana and Illinois. And I happened to spy, I'm riding with my sister and her husband's driving. And I'm sitting up front in the front seat, and I just happen to spy out the corner of my eye. There's a bald eagle in the middle of Robinson, Illinois, and it's right there next to the park in town. And I turned into a 10-year-old, and James is trying to drive, and I'm reaching over there. James, look at that. There's a bald eagle over there. That bird I'd pay attention to. There's enough starlings and sparrows and other dirty birds that, you know, nobody pays attention to those things. Nobody cares unless they're eating your songbird food. Nobody cares about them. And yet God watches over them. God provides for them. God takes care of them. God take care of you. And so he says at the end of this, so do not worry about, or I'm sorry, verse 33, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, all these things will be added to you. Now, that's not set up in the sense of in like a promise that if you pay with your righteousness, then God is obliged to deliver so many pounds of food a year or whatever. It's not set up that way. The point is that you do what God expects of you. You do your part. You take care of your place. The old fashioned statement, you whittle on your end of the stick and God will take care of his end. You let God take care of God's business. You just take care of your own. Christians, trust God. Because stuff just isn't reliable. I'll burn through this really quick. I've had this old Wrangler broke down on me every time I really needed it, which was every time I got into it. But every time I got into it and I needed it to do something for it, it was always breaking down. I'm sure many of you have had similar happenings. You think about those things that we go to the store, we buy, they're all brand new and shiny and they just look so nice. You know, your brand new car, whatever it is, it's not new to you, but it's new. It's not new, but it's new to you. You know, that kind of thing. And it still has that new car smell in it. All those nice things that we have, we save up for, or we put it on credit, or however we get it home. And you know what that stuff turns into? It turns into tomorrow's trash. Have you ever been by a junkyard? All of those automobiles out there, all of them were once brand new. It's just shiny garbage. That's all it is. It's not reliable. You can't count on it. It'll be good for a while and then it'll fall apart. And I'll tell you, even myself, that's the way this body is. It's going to fall apart. Well, I need to move on. There's a lot of other stuff that I want to talk about. Now, this is a longer slide than I thought. That would be good. Let's move on. There's some other stuff we want to talk about. A Christian's careful of his opinions. Let me reiterate that. I don't want to skip over it. A Christian ought to be careful with his opinions. Look at Matthew chapter 7. Surely you have heard the very first verse. Do not judge. Do not judge so that you will not be judged. Jesus explains that, and he says, for in the way that you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye and do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? You're a hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. But notice verse 6, because verse 6 goes along with the first five verses. This is not an entirely new subject. Goes along with what he's just said. Do not give what is holy to dogs, and do not throw your pearls before swine, or they will trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. Yeah, does Jesus forbid making any kind of judgments at all? I don't think so. And we could give all kinds of illustrations about that. We could talk about particular aspects of worship, particular lifestyles. We could talk about all those kinds of things. There may be opinions that we all share have about those things, but then there are things that the Bible specifically teaches on these matters. Does Jesus forbid us making any comment on any of this? Well, I don't think that that's the point that Jesus is making here. What Jesus is doing is he's warning us about two extremes. On the one hand, don't be too critical. Don't be too critical in your judgments. What does he say? Do not judge so that you'll not be judged, because in the way that you judge, you will be judged. If you are a critical person, don't be surprised if people are critical of the fact that you're critical. It's fair play. If you're always telling people your opinions, don't be surprised if they don't want to give you a piece of their mind. Don't be too critical, overly critical, overly harsh, because it'll come back to you. Not just in the Lord's judgment, but in your neighbor's. Be careful about being too critical. But on the other hand, don't be too lenient either. What is it that he's saying in verse 6? Is he not still talking about judgments? Let me ask you a question. How do you know what is holy? How do you know what is holy? How do you know what the pearls are? How do you know those things, if not by judgments? Do you not have to make a judgment to determine what is holy? What are the pearls? More than that, is he talking about four-legged creatures or two-legged creatures here in this verse? You have to make a judgment to know who the dogs and the hogs are. Right? What he's saying is, just be careful of your judgments. Be careful of your opinions. Well, I'll wrap it up real quickly. There's a number of other things that we could spend hours talking about, but just a couple other things real quickly. Christians are equitable. There in chapter 7, this is where the golden rule comes from. But in chapter 7, in verse 7, he says, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you shall find. Knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds. And to him who knocks it will be open. Or what man is there among you who, when his son asks for a loaf, will give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, he'll not give him a snake, will he? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give what is good to those who ask him? In everything, therefore. Again, verse 12, the golden rule fits at the end of what he's just said. This is the way that God treats you. And so how should you treat people? This is the way that God treats people. How should you, as God's people, as God's children, those that are pointing people to the Lord, how should you treat people? Therefore, in everything, treat people in the same way that you want that you want them to treat you. Because this is what the whole law and the prophets is about. The Christians are equitable. Christians are fair. That's the way that we ought to be. Christians are focused. He says in verse 13 and 14, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. For the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it. There's a great passage over in the book of Luke, in Luke chapter 13, where Jesus' disciples come to him, and they ask Jesus, they say, Jesus, are there only a few that are going to be saved? Now, what does Jesus say here? The disciples ask, I think, a reasonable question. Are there only a few that are going to be saved? You know what Jesus does? This blows my mind. But there are a number of places in the Bible where God or Jesus specifically are asked questions and they don't answer the question. It's almost as though what they're saying is, look, you're asking the wrong question. And Luke chapter 13 is one of them, because he doesn't tell his disciples yes or no. They ask a yes or no question, but he doesn't say yes or no. You know what he says? He says, strive to enter. Strive to enter. Because here's the point. What difference does it make how many are saved if you're lost? What difference does it make? If everybody in the world was saved, if you had a 99.9% chance of being saved because everybody else was, but you're lost, what difference did it make what the percentage was? You strive to enter. Make sure that you get there. Christians are focused. Christians are wary. Verse 15. Beware, he says. Beware. And he talks about different, false teachers and various things like that. One last. Christians do. You remember the way that he finishes the sermon? The conclusion is about the wise men and the foolish man. Two men, he says, they both build houses, and it seems like they both build the same house. They have the same design. They have the same storm. What is the difference? It's the foundation. And in this text, what is the foundation that he's talking about? The foundation in this context is not specifically Jesus. Now, we want to build our life on Jesus. Yes, that's true, but that's not particularly what Jesus is saying here. What is the foundation? What is the difference between the two? Jesus says, the wise man is the one who hears these words of mine and acts upon them, and the foolish man is the one who hears these same words of mine. Same sermon, same day. Same preacher, the perfect preacher, in fact. And yet one goes away and does what he's learned, and the other does not. And that's all the difference. It's in the doing. And I'll tell you, the more that you read through the Bible, I'm often astounded by when I think about various characters of the Bible, I wonder how they felt about the things that they were being told to do. You remember the story of Abraham and Isaac? Isaac's to be sacrificed. I think, what was Abraham thinking? Or what did he tell Sarah? You ever wonder about how did he get out of the house? What did he tell Sarah? The Bible doesn't focus on how they felt. That's not to say that they didn't have feelings. They didn't have fears. The Bible doesn't focus on those things. It focuses on what they did. Look at the book of James. James, it's often been described as the New Testament Proverbs. It just a bunch of random points that are being made, and I don't think that's the case at all. There's a theme that runs through the book of James, and it's all that. If you boil down the book of James into one word, it's the word do. Be ye doers of the word, and not merely hearers that delude themselves. And James is so very similar to the Sermon on the Mount. Christians do. We don't just come and sit down. We do. If there's anyone here tonight that needs to act upon what they know to be true, Jesus Christ came. died upon a cross, rose again by the power of God 3 days later. That he likewise is coming again to receive his own to himself. Then won't you come, repenting of your sins, confessing this Christ to be your Lord, Lord of this world and Lord of your life. Be baptized for the forgiveness of those sins. Won't you come while we stand and sing?